But these five kings had fled and hidden themselves in a cave at Makkedah. And it was told Joshua, saying, "The five kings have been found hidden in the cave at Makkedah." So Joshua said, "Roll large stones against the mouth of the cave and set men by it to guard them. And do not stay there yourselves, but pursue your enemies and attack their rear guard. Do not allow them to enter their cities, for Yahweh your God has delivered them into your hand." Then it happened, while Joshua and the children of Israel made an end of slaying them with a very great slaughter, till they had finished, that those who escaped entered fortified cities. And all the people returned to the camp, to Joshua at Makkedah, in peace. No one moved his tongue against any of the children of Israel. Then Joshua said, "Open the mouth of the cave and bring out those five kings to me from the cave." And they did so and brought out those five kings to him from the cave: the king of Jerusalem, the king of Hebron, the king of Jarmuth, the king of Lachish, and the king of Eglon. So it was, when they brought out those kings to Joshua, that Joshua called for all the men of Israel and said to the captains of the men of war who went with him, "Come near, put your feet on the necks of these kings." And they drew near and put their feet on their necks. Then Joshua said to them, "Do not be afraid nor be dismayed. Be strong and of good courage, for thus Yahweh will do to all your enemies against whom you fight." And afterward Joshua struck them and killed them and hanged them on five trees. And they were hanging on the trees until evening. So it was at the time of the going down of the sun that Joshua commanded, and they took them down from the trees, cast them into the cave where they had been hidden, and laid large stones against the cave's mouth, which remain until this very day. This is the word of the Lord. Please be seated. Last week we read of the beginning of the conquest of the southern portion of the Promised Land. Adoni-Zedek, king of Jerusalem, formed an alliance with four other Amorite kings to attack Gibeon, which had recently allied itself with Israel. When Gibeon appealed to Joshua for Israel to come help them, Joshua honored their covenant and brought Israelite forces quickly via a forced march through the night. Their surprise attack against the Amorites, aided by a divine miracle, led to a rout of the forces arrayed against Gibeon. As the verses we will examine tonight show, the initial victory at Beth Horon is followed by a battle that rages on until Israel gains a general victory in the south. We're going to explore our passage tonight following a two-part outline. First of all, five kings executed in verses 16 through 27, and then six cities conquered, verses 28 through 43. Hence our message title, Five Kings, Six Cities, One Victorious God. And that's what we'll be reading about. So we want to enter into this as the testimony to God's victories. We begin with five kings executed. In verse 16 we read, "But these five kings had fled and hidden themselves in a cave at Makkedah." Now the five kings were identified earlier in the chapter, back in verse 3. They are Adoni-Zedek, king of Jerusalem, Hoham, king of Hebron, Piram, king of Jarmuth, Japhia, king of Lachish, Debir, king of Eglon. As their forces were fleeing those of Israel and Gibeon, these five kings flee to a cave for refuge. Now, that's not exactly a picture of great might, is it? It's not a picture of kings leading their forces in battle. These powerful men are reduced to hiding in a cave. And when I read this, some of you will be able to remember with me the first Gulf War, when Saddam Hussein was ultimately found hiding in a hole in the ground. That man who had been so powerful, had ruled with an iron hand over his country, was reduced to hiding in a hole. Well, that's not much different than the picture of these kings abandoning their forces and hiding in a cave. How the mighty have fallen. Well, Joshua heard about them and he took action, verses 17 through 19. "And it was told Joshua, saying, 'The five kings of the Amorites have been found hidden in a cave at Makkedah.' So Joshua said, 'Roll large stones against the mouth of the cave and set men by it to guard them. Do not stay there yourselves, but pursue your enemies and attack their rear guard. Do not allow them to enter their cities, for Yahweh your God has delivered them into your hand.'" The cave to which the kings had fled for refuge now becomes their prison. Large stones are rolled against the cave entrance to trap them inside. These kings who commanded armies are completely powerless. Commentator Gordon McConville notes, "Their isolation from the action expresses the actual impotence of this power that would resist the divine purpose and underlines the inevitable defeat of their armies. Joshua can safely leave them under guard while the action in the field is pursued to its conclusion." And there's some wordplay here in verse 19 when Joshua says, "Do not stay there yourselves," saying that the armies don't need to stay here. They can go chase the other forces. The verb that's translated "stay there" is the very same one that was used of the moon standing still in verse 13. And you remember that great miracle last week, the moon, the sun, standing still. Well, unlike the moon and the sun standing still, that's not what these Israelite forces are to do. They are to keep on moving, pressing the attack, and pursuing their fleeing enemies. And Joshua gives us a specific command to which is attached divine assurance. He says, "Do not allow them to enter their cities, for Yahweh your God has delivered them into your hand." And once again, we see this balance here. Divine sovereignty does not negate human responsibility. The battle belongs to the Lord. He will give them into their hand, but the Israelites still had to fight. Now we get a summary statement of the result of that pursuit in verses 20 through 21. "Then it happened, while Joshua and the children of Israel made an end of slaying them with a very great slaughter, till they had finished, that those who escaped entered fortified cities. And all the people returned to the camp, to Joshua at Makkedah, in peace. No one moved his tongue against any of the children of Israel." Now following the principles of holy harem warfare, Israel slayed their enemies with a very great slaughter. Some did escape to fortified cities, and we're going to read more about those cities shortly. Nevertheless, the Israelite victory was so great that they were able to return to Joshua's camp at Makkedah in safety and in peace. And the final sentence in verse 21 literally says that no one sharpened his tongue against any of the children of Israel. And this employs an idiom that was previously used back in Exodus 11. On the night of the final plague against the firstborn in Egypt, Moses tells the Israelites how the Egyptian firstborn will be slain, but then he adds in Exodus 11:7, "But against none of the children of Israel shall a dog sharpen its tongue, against man or beast, that you may know that Yahweh does make a difference between the Egyptians and Israel." Now, the use of that same idiom here of the Canaanites might both remind Israel of Yahweh's previous faithfulness to them when they were in Egypt. We've heard many echoes of the Exodus story. But it also may liken the Canaanites to dogs, which were despised creatures in the ancient Near East. As no dog had spoken against Israel in Egypt, now no Canaanite will speak against Israel in the Promised Land. Now the story returns to the five imprisoned kings, starting at verse 22. "Then Joshua said, 'Open the mouth of the cave and bring out those five kings to me from the cave.' And they did so and brought out those five kings to him from the cave, the king of Jerusalem, the king of Hebron, the king of Jarmuth, the king of Lachish, and the king of Eglon. So it was, when they brought out those kings to Joshua, that Joshua called for all the men of Israel and said to the captains of the men of war who went with him, 'Come near, put your feet on the necks of these kings.' And they drew near and put their feet on their necks. Then Joshua said to them, 'Do not be afraid, nor be dismayed. Be strong and of good courage, for thus Yahweh will do to all your enemies against whom you fight.'" Joshua has the five kings brought out of the cave, and he commands the captains of his forces, "Put your feet on the necks of these kings." So you need to picture this. These kings are now on the ground, and the captains of the forces are putting their feet upon their necks. This is a gesture of victory. It's similar to other language we find in the Old Testament. We read, for example, in Psalm 18, 39 through 40, "You have armed me with strength for the battle. You have subdued under me those who rose up against me. You have also given me the necks of my enemies, so that I destroy those who hated me." Or Psalm 110:1, "Yahweh said to my Lord, 'Sit at my right hand till I make your enemies your footstool.'" And again, what's a footstool for? A foot is resting upon just like the foot resting upon the necks of those kings. Joshua wants his commanders to be confident in future battles. And he assures them of future victories because they will be just as certain as the victory over these kings who are now under their feet. Ralph Davis comments, "The leader's feet upon the necks of these prostrate kings was an acted parable and an assuring sign of how Yahweh would certainly place all their enemies beneath them. The symbolic action is intended as a visible encouragement to the people of God." And surely it was an image that the people of Israel would not soon forget, their own military leaders standing with their feet upon the necks of these defeated Canaanite kings. But that was not the final action taken against these kings. We read on, verse 26, "And afterward Joshua struck them and killed them and hanged them on five trees, and they were hanging on the trees until evening. So it was at the time of the going down of the sun that Joshua commanded, and they took them down from the trees, cast them into the cave where they had been hidden, and laid large stones against the cave's mouth, which remain until this very day." Joshua now strikes, kills, and then hangs the bodies of the five kings on trees until sundown. But then when the sun was setting, in accordance to Mosaic law, the bodies were taken down from the trees. Now there's several notes of irony to be heard in this passage. Back in verse 1 of the chapter, it was knowledge of how Israel had triumphed over Ai and its king that led Adoni-Zedek to form an alliance against Israel. But now, what did he receive? The very same treatment and death that the king of Ai had received, who was also hung upon it, who was killed and then hung upon a tree, and he was covered with stones. Furthermore, the cave, which had been the king's refuge, and then their prison, would now forever be their tomb. As stones had been piled upon the corpse of the king of Ai, now stones were laid against the mouth of the cave, which we're told remain until this very day. And this is thus another significant use of stones forming a covenant memorial to remind future generations of Yahweh's faithfulness in the conquest. Stones over the king that had been defeated at Ai. There's stones at this cave. You could go about the promised land, and from place to place, there were these memorials reminding the people of the Lord's past faithfulness to them. The narrative now returns to the follow-up to the earlier battles. Remember the note in verse 20 that those who escaped entered fortified cities. What is to these cities that attention now turns? So we have our second point, six cities conquered, in verses 28 through 43. There's a great deal of repetition in this section, and we're going to read through it portion by portion, just making brief comments along the way before considering the summary statement in verses 40 through 43. And we're going to read about six cities. The first is Makkedah, verse 28. This is near where Joshua has been encamped. "On that day, Joshua took Makkedah and struck it and its king with the edge of the sword. He utterly destroyed them, all the people who were in it. He let none remain. He also did to the king of Makkedah as he had done to the king of Jericho." So we can note just a few things here. In Makkedah, all the people are destroyed. And we're also told the king was killed, as had been done to the king at Jericho. Now we're going to have this refrain, but it's going to vary a little bit as we go through. But here at Makkedah, they're recalling the victory at Jericho. The next city we come to is Libna, verses 29 and 30. "Then Joshua passed from Makkedah and all Israel with him to Libna. And they fought against Libna. And Yahweh also delivered it and its king into the hand of Israel. He struck it and all the people who were in it with the edge of the sword. He let none remain in it, but did to its king as he had done to the king of Jericho." And again, all the people are destroyed. And the king was killed, and again, it's as was done in Jericho, as was done to the king of Jericho. The next city we come to is Lachish in verses 31 through 33. "Then Joshua passed from Libna and all Israel with him to Lachish, and they encamped against it and fought against it. And Yahweh delivered Lachish into the hand of Israel, who took it on the second day, and struck it and all the people who were in it with the edge of the sword, according to all that he had done to Libna. Then Horam, king of Gezer, came up to help Lachish, and Joshua struck him and his people until he left him none remaining. Now in Lachish, again, we're told that all people have been destroyed, but now we're told not that as was done in Jericho, but as was done in Libna. We're looking back to a more recent victory in this very same campaign. And the king of Lachish is not mentioned. Why do you think the king of Lachish is not mentioned? He was one of the five kings that was just killed, that had been holed up in the cave at Makkedah. We're also told that Horam, king of Gezer, comes to the aid of Lachish, and he and his people are destroyed. Now, they don't actually go to that city and destroy the city, but those who came to help Lachish are destroyed in this battle. Next, we come to Eglon, verses 34 to 35. From Lachish, Joshua passed to Eglon, and all Israel with him, and they encamped against it and fought against it. They took it on that day and struck it with the edge of the sword. All the people were in it. He utterly destroyed that day, according to all he had done at Lachish. So all the people are destroyed, as had been done at Lachish. Now looking to the one battle just previous to this one. And again, the king of Eglon is not mentioned because he was also one of the five who was killed at Makkedah. That brings us to Hebron, verses 36 and 37. So Joshua went up from Eglon and all Israel with him to Hebron, and they fought against it. And they took it and struck it with the edge of the sword, its king and its cities, and all the people who were in it. He left none remaining according to all that he had done to Eglon, but utterly destroyed it and all the people who were in it. Now here we're told its king, all its cities, and all the people who were in it were destroyed, as has been done in Eglon. So again, he looks at the battle just prior to this one. Now here he refers to all its cities. Hebron, it seems, was sort of the chief city of a little regional kingdom, and all of these cities were destroyed. Now we know that Hoham, the king of Hebron, was among those killed at Makkedah, and so this king must have been his successor that was already in place, and his successor is now killed in this battle. And finally, we come to Debir, verses 38 and 39. Then Joshua returned and all Israel with him to Debir, and they fought against it. And he took it and its king and all its cities. They struck them with the edge of the sword and utterly destroyed all the people who were in it. He left none remaining as he had done to Hebron. So he did to Debir and its king, as he had done also to Libna and its king. And here we're told that all the people and the king are destroyed, as been done in two of the previous battles, both in Hebron and at Lachish. Before moving on to the concluding summary that begins at verse 40, I do want to note a few statements in these passages that I didn't highlight as we went through. Verse 30, and Yahweh also delivered it, that is Libna and its king, into the hand of Israel. Verse 32, and Yahweh delivered Lachish into the hand of Israel. What is mentioned explicitly in these two instances is surely implied in all. It was Yahweh who was delivering these cities into the hand of Israel, just as had been pronounced when the Israelite captains put their feet on the necks of those five Amorite kings. They have now subdued six cities and a number of kings within those cities, and it was the work of the Lord. That brings us to a summary of the southern conquest in verses 40 through 43. Oh, and I should have told you. Look at the back of your handout. I had found this, and you'll see sort of the battles here. You see where Gezer is, and Lachish, and Eglon, and Hebron, and Debir. This is tracking the further invasion that we read about tonight and we discussed. And you can see some of the cities that were attacked there. So you can keep that in mind as I read this summary statement. So Joshua conquered all the land, the mountain country and the south, and the lowland and the wilderness slopes, and all their kings. He left none remaining, but utterly destroyed all that breathed, as Yahweh God of Israel had commanded. And Joshua conquered them from Kadesh Barnea as far as Gaza, and all the country of Goshen, even as far as Gibeon. All these kings and their land Joshua took at one time, because Yahweh, the God of Israel, fought for Israel. Then Joshua returned and all Israel with him to the camp at Gilgal. And we'll just note a few key points here about this southern campaign. The first is that the southern victory was extensive. You know, we don't have all those places on this particular map, but this is basically the whole southern portion of Canaan that is embraced in this conquest and in these victories. It was an extensive victory, and it was a total victory. He talks about all the kings, all the lands, all the people. They had engaged in this holy warfare as instructed by Yahweh, and their victory was total. Finally, their southern victory was due to the fact that Yahweh, God of Israel, fought for Israel in verse 42, just as we noted in some of the previous descriptions of those battles. It was not simply Israel's might. It was not simply Israel's ingenuity. It was their obedience to the Lord that the Lord blessed unto victory. But the victory ultimately belonged to him. Now, by way of application, let me note again how the victory of Joshua anticipates the greater victory of the greater Joshua to come. We noted how the image of conquerors placing the feet on the necks of conquered kings was an image used in several places in the Old Testament. One of those that we read from was Psalm 110. I want you now to listen to how Peter applies this passage to Jesus in his great sermon on the day of Pentecost. It's in Acts chapter 2. I'm going to start at verse 34, but just prior to this, Peter has quoted from Psalm 16. And he has applied that psalm to Jesus. And now we read in Acts 2, beginning with verse 34, "For David did not ascend into the heavens, but he says himself," and here's the quote from Psalm 110, "The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand till I make your enemies your footstool. Therefore, let all the house of Israel know assuredly that God has made this Jesus, whom you crucified, both Lord and Christ." Looking back to Psalm 10, he applies it and says, God has made Jesus both Lord and Christ. This is David's Lord from Psalm 110, whose enemies have become his footstool, which again is like having his feet upon their necks. It is then a portrait of messianic victory. We have the same kind of promise language in Hebrews 10, verses 12 through 13, again speaking of Jesus. "But this man, after he had offered one sacrifice for sins forever, sat down at the right hand of God, from that time waiting until his enemies are made his footstool." Again, picture his feet upon his enemies. So you have that image in your mind. But then go back to Acts chapter 2 and listen to how that passage continues, picking up in the very next verse after where he left off, verse 37. "Now when they heard this," and that's that message about Jesus being this messianic victor over his enemies, "when they heard this, they were cut to the heart and said to Peter and the rest of the apostles, 'Men and brethren, what shall we do?' Then Peter said to them, 'Repent, and let every one of you be baptized in the name of Jesus Christ for the remission of sins, and you shall receive the gift of the Holy Spirit. For the promise is to you and to your children and to all who are far off, as many as the Lord our God will call.' And with many other words he testified and exhorted them, saying, 'Be saved from this perverse generation.' Then those who gladly received his word were baptized, and that day about 3,000 souls were added to them." Jesus will be victorious over his enemies. As Paul expresses it in Philippians 2, "Therefore God also has highly exalted him and given him the name which is above every name, that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow, of those in heaven and of those on earth and of those under the earth, and that every tongue should confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father." And the promising picture we get from Acts 2 and the conversion of about 3,000 souls is that many enemies of Christ will be subdued by coming to faith in him. Many knees will bow in true faith, confessing Christ as Lord. As we learned this morning from John, Jesus' kingdom is not advanced by force or violence. Our holy war is not like Israel's holy war under Joshua. Our holy war is a spiritual warfare centered upon the proclamation that Christ is King and the call for all to bow their knees in faith before him, lest one day they find themselves as his footstool in judgment. The success of Joshua in the southern campaign in Canaan should inspire us to trust in the greater worldwide success of the greater Joshua in history. And it should motivate us to enter the lists in spiritual warfare by announcing Christ's kingdom and by living as faithful citizens of that kingdom. If God blessed Peter's preaching on Pentecost to the salvation of many, what might he do in our day through a truly revived church? May we hope, pray, and live toward such a vision.